Te reo ererangi o te mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora. You're listening to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. This week, we are going to hear from Naomi Arnold, who'll be here to hear live for the Word Festival, talking about her wonderful book, Northbound. Then we'll hear Ivor Popovich with a grim prognosis on our health system. And we'll end the show with Claire Turnbull talking about how to end your fight with food. Northbound, Four Seasons of Solitude on Te Araroa, is what I have termed a mission memoir. Naomi Arnold fearlessly documents the 9 months she spent walking 3,000 kilometres the length of Aotearoa on Te Araroa, New Zealand's great path. It's a memoir of solitude and tenacity, of love and friendship, of Aotearoa's wild splendour, and about how we are changed by doing things that push us to our absolute edge. Tēnā koe, Naomi. It's a total pleasure to have you on the show.
Kia ora, thank you so much for having me. It's great.
Cool. Okay, Naomi, most of us kind of daydream about something like this. It feels maybe in reach, but also like chunks of it would likely be more than enough for most of us. So tell us why you think some people like you, get hooked.
I think for me it was the length of time that I had wanted to do it. So I was 21 or 22, so it was 20 years ago when I first heard about the trail, and I read about it in Jeff Chappell's book, Te Araroa, One Man Walks His Dream, and that was published in around 2002-ish. And he and his wife Miriam Beetson and a group had... but really spearheaded by those two, had been trying to get this concept of a national walking trail, the length of New Zealand, established. There are obviously much longer-term established trails in the United States and Europe and elsewhere, through hikes, where you spend an extended period of time on the road. And I was I enjoyed tramping when I was at university. And for some reason, I picked up this book 20 years ago and just thought, oh, I want to do that. And the trail didn't open for another maybe 10 years after that. When it did open, I was living in Nelson and I was reporting for the Nelson Mail and as a health and environment reporter and a feature writer. And I was still enjoying tramping, especially the Nelson region, obviously. And then I thought, that's it. I'm going to go and do this. Like, I'm going to take 4 to 6 months and go and walk this trail. But I was also had a new job. I think I had just managed to buy my first home at that point. Back when things were a lot easier. So there was no way I could do that. I could not take 4 to 6 months off. So it basically took me another 12 years or something to get the time, the money to get there, to be able to do something like that. Like, it's a very privileged thing to be able to do, is to take time off work. And I still couldn't take time off work because I freelance now. I'm a full-time freelance journalist, and I just tried to cram this trail into my freelance work. But I took my iPad. I had a little bit left to finish, and I thought I did in January. So I took my iPad. I was like, it'll be fine. I'll just finish it on the road. But that actually ended up taking till May, because it was a massive project that completely exploded. When I thought it was over, it exploded again.
So the logistics of something like this mean, quite a lot of planning, don't they? You've got to work out a whole lot. It's not something that you could decide to do, to start next month and just head off and do.
No, I think you could. Yep. It depends on your life state. If you've got children, like, obviously it's going to take a long amount of time to arrange if you've got family mortgages. But if you are someone without many commitments, you could pick up and go and walk this thing, because I was not particularly fit when I started, because I had so much work to do. And basically you walk day after day, but you rest if you want. The first day could be 8 kilometres or it could be 30 kilometres. You just, if you give yourself enough time.
How long is it going to take you if you do 8Ks a day?
Oh, well, it'll take forever, but it's your first day. So you could pick up and go and do it. If you gave yourself enough time for your body to adapt and didn't rush through, you could definitely, like, you train on the trail, really.
And so tell us also about how much it mattered to you to walk every inch and how you feel about that in retrospect.
Yeah, I knew myself, I knew that if I skipped the boring bits, I would skip every boring bit, you know, and then how much of the trail would I actually walk? So for me, there's a lot of different reasons people walk the trail. I liked the idea of following this line, this line on the map, and the rigor of doing that was what appealed to me. Other people just want to see the sights or get fit or whatever, connect with their family. But for me, I love maps. I guess I've got a spatial brain, and I wanted to follow the line. So that meant walking every step, which I did all the way up until there was flooding in Auckland, south of Auckland, and I could not go on, and to reroute would have been another day, and I would have had to walk illegally on State Highway 1, and I'd already been picked up by the police because of that.
So at that point, it's a good episode in the book. In fact, just listeners, every episode in the book is an absolute delight. This is one that is highly recommended for everybody wild at heart. But picking up on that, talking about that through walk, you've used that term a couple of times, and that kind of commitment to the line for you. Not everybody has that, but there's a community of people who are through walkers, aren't they? And
yes.
And you document that. It's a subculture most of us don't even know exists. How much of a, is that like a community that you feel a real heart connection to now?
Yes. I mean, the thing was, I didn't meet many people except for the southbounders. I was going northbound.
Yeah.
Southbound is far more common. So I did not establish the trail family, the trail fam that people get. If they walk southbound, they quickly connect with a group of people. So I would more connect with the concept of through hiking in spirit rather than knowing a lot of them or having a lot of exchanges with a lot of them. But yeah, I did discover a definite subculture of grit, smelliness, raggedness, physical torment, really.
Influencers and things like that were fascinating to hear about, like that there's this kind of online community of these people connecting with each other and sharing stories and influencing each other about nutrition and all sorts of things. Yeah.
Yes, gear, all sorts. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that was a fun aspect. But you mentioned you didn't get to sink into belonging to that because you were walking the opposite direction. So tell us about the impacts of that loneliness and how you suffered and what that means for you now.
I was not expecting to be so alone and so lonely, but I very quickly was, and day after day of watching people ahead of me in the hut book, I'd missed by a day, but I was alone again, setting off again, I began to get quite strange, I think. I found it difficult, after a couple of weeks, after a couple of months, I found it difficult to look at people in the eye. I avoided people while craving connection. But the physical pain of loneliness, you hear about this maybe with the elderly or with people feeling isolated, young mothers or other types of people, but the physical pain of feeling so alone and wanting to connect but feeling unable to, it's a very painful gut feeling, like a gut and heart, like I'm holding my torso right now remembering what it was like, and I would often hold my torso and just cry deeply, that's what I'm crying about, how sad I felt and how just pathetic it was.
Is that a like a grief that it's still sore if you go there? Like you can, like that loneliness, is it like a grief now if you visit it again, you can
evoke it? I can still feel it. Yeah, definitely. It was very powerful. And it made me, towards the end of the trail, when I started, towards the end in the Northland, when I started to connect with more people again because it was easier walking, more people around, I experienced a lot of joy in connecting, and I was very chatty with friendly with strangers like I never would have really normally been. So, but it has left me with, I'm much more open, like I'll just strike up conversations, but I won't forget what that felt like. It was very powerful.
I found that particularly inspiring from the book, personally. I made a commitment to myself to be more conversational and to kind of make connections more readily. So thanks for the inspiration. Has completing the trail, or like your experience on it, has it changed your attitudes to your body?
Becoming quite fit, like the last day I did was 62 kilometres. In that week, I'd done 250 or something, like over all kinds of terrain. I did not notice the changes, it still felt painful, but I was just able to go forever. Like that 62 Ks along the beach, I didn't sit down all day. Like I sat down for 5 minutes and just kept going from 5 a.m. till 8:30 p.m. or whatever. And then it was when I got home really that I noticed, and I was just jumping out of my skin, you know, because I didn't have to sit down and write the book for another 3 weeks to finish it off, because I wrote the book on trail. But I was very jumpy. Like I needed a lot of exercise, like running like a dog. My ankle was bung still after months, and I just ran on it and ran on it. Like I'd sprint, get into the beach and just sprint into the salt air. I have a new appreciation for what it feels to be super fit, even though 7 months later I've pretty much gone back to normal.
Right, and that competence in your body as a woman, did it make you think about your body more as a tool, or were you already in that space anyway, less kind of objectifying and more kind of what can I achieve in the world, or did the walk help with that in any way? I just think some of our women listeners are so used to thinking about our bodies in one way that this does that resonate at all?
As a woman, it's really hard to separate the visual from the functional. And I obviously noticed physical changes, weight loss, muscle build, and I obviously enjoyed those from like a socially acceptable visual point of view. They are fading now. But I think what women should take out of that is the ability to get super fit as well within your grasp.
Right.
Let's just take the visual and out of that entirely. But the feeling that you have, the happiness, and just feeling so good for running upstairs, you can be any size and shape and still feel like that.
Yeah.
I was never a waif or anything, but to feel better was amazing.
Yeah, cool. That's cool. You tell us in the book that the possibility of trail romance was a thing that you and your partner had discussed, and that seems obvious, but it still feels brave. And were you worried about being open about that in the book?
No, I wasn't. My husband, Douglas, we've been together 13 years, married for 8 or something. Like we're well down the relationship pathway in terms of healthy communication and stuff. And he had said to me, what if you meet somebody? We should probably talk about this. And I was like, no, that's never going to happen. And then he said, you know, I think I'd be okay if you quote unquote enjoyed yourself.
Yeah.
And I was like, good God, like we've never discussed anything like that. But he was like, just see what happens. And then we had this joke that I would meet a guy called Marco, you know, and I would fall in love with Marco. And Doug said, as long as you come home again, that's okay. You know, he knew how much he wanted to do this. He was really proud of me. And he turned out to be amazingly enlightened on that subject. And that, I don't want to do any spoilers, but there was an opportunity.
Yeah.
That did come up. And I did have to exercise that choice. I'm not going to do any spoilers. But that was an unusual step in our marriage to consider that. Like, that's quite out of the box for most people.
It does feel obvious when you're going to be away for those lengths of time, and especially in the context of the loneliness that you suffered as well. It's kind of like an obvious thing to think about, but it felt brave. And thanks, so, you know, in the sharing of it felt brave. How much did it mean to you to have his unconditional backing like that? It's a symbol, isn't it? That conversation is a symbol of his backing. How much did that mean?
Hey, it was everything. I was working, but he was financially holding the fort down, and I had saved. We both worked full time. It was everything. There were difficulties along the way. He got very lonely himself. We did have kind of arguments, you know, about how lonely he was and how long it was taking, blah, blah, because I was working. But he made it happen for me entirely. And if I was 23 or alone and I had been able to do it myself, it wouldn't have been an issue. But there were two people walking that, and he supported me the whole way. And I really owe him, like, you know, I joke in the book that he's got points now to spend on his own
adventure somewhere.
We'll do that, I'm sure.
Cool. So in the aftermath of it all, like, Do you worry that nothing else, no other challenge is going to feel as significant?
No, not at all. I mean, every day, life is interesting every day. There's something that comes up, personal relationships. There's always something you can take on. Like I've been training for a half marathon. The training has been going terribly, actually, because I've got a lasting injury from the trail I need to fix. But there's always something new to look at. And I don't have my next big goal yet. Like the book was a big thing that's come out. But I'm just waiting for the next inspiration to strike.
Right. Okay. It's just the sense that you have of you at the end. Like you talk about you're super fit by the end, but to be honest, the impression you get reading the book is that you're super wrecked by the end, you know, like, you know, arriving at Cape Ring in a mess in many ways, you know, like wrung out. And so can you imagine wanting to push yourself there again?
Yes. Yeah, I was a high school runner, so I did some sprint, trail, track and cross country all through high school. So I'm used to being physically destroyed, and the bonuses that you get from that once if you give enough recovery time, your fitness grows. So I would not push my feet that far again, but the rest of me I was okay with.
There's one episode in the book where you get this weird rash thing on your feet. I was so worried for you. It was quite early in the mix and it was like, oh my God, that sounds so horrible. Feet,
so painful.
Feet are an issue the whole way, aren't they? For everybody.
They are for everybody. Yeah. It's looking after them is so difficult and so necessary.
Yeah. Cool. So you've mentioned him before, but Jeff, he gets a cameo in the book, doesn't he? You stay.
Yes.
Can you tell us, he's obviously a wonderful support, but all along the trail, especially in that North Island section, the Trail Angels. Tell us about Trail Angels.
Yeah, the Trail Angels open their homes for koha, maybe $40, maybe $20. Like, there's a suggested donation, which isn't quite koha, but that's what it's called. Or a flat out fee, and they can give you meals, showers, beds, and they are in the app, and you contact them and they say, yes, you can stay tonight, or I'm sorry, we don't have a room, and you go and stay with them. And in some places there are no accommodation options, so they're absolutely necessary, and they will also go out of their way to pick you up, take you for food, like, depending on who they are, and offer services that you really need in some of these remote locations. That they are absolute joys and just wonderful people.
Yeah, it's a is that true of through walks around the world? Is that a kind of a feature of through walks? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a United States tradition, really, which is quite different. Like people, like in the Pacific Crest Trail, people will go up to trailheads, open up their boots, cook barbecues, hamburgers, have trail magic, which are, you know, snacks along the trail. Here in New Zealand, it's slightly more of like a donation-based accommodation service, really.
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely a feature of through hiking as Trail Angels.
It's interesting because reading it as a, you know, New Zealand citizen, you want to think that there's something unique in our culture about that kind of hospitality. But it's really about that. It's really just about humanity, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And we do have, you know, Māori concepts of welcomeness and things that are unique to us. But it is people wanting to meet other people from all around the world, a great way to connect. A lot of the Trail Angels, like, they were very interested in the trail, they supported it, and for the walkers it was just so much gratitude.
Yeah.
That was a wonderful way to connect with people over something shared.
Nō reira, ngā mihi Naomi. The book is Northbound, Four Seasons of Solitude on Te Araroa by Naomi Arnold, published by HarperCollins and selling out, I understand, at local bookstores.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
A dim prognosis is an account of our failing health system from the perspective of a junior doctor, Ivor Popovich, who will become a fully-fledged specialist in emergency medicine in August 2025. It's a funny book, except it really isn't. The humour is the black variety used to self-inoculate people in the system from absolute despair. Dr. Emma Wahipiana, author of the prize-winning There's a Cure for This, Exposé of Health Inequality in Aotearoa, provides a heartfelt cover note endorsement for Ivor. Brave, funny, and heart-rendingly sad, every healthcare worker in Aotearoa will feel seen. Ivor, thanks very much for joining us on Bookends to discuss your book. Tēnā koe, congratulations on your specialist graduation and ngā mihi for your work helping to care for Aotearoa.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So I don't actually know where to start when I was planning these questions. The health system you describe is so dreadfully backwards and messed up. And yet, when terrible things happen, like the eruption at Whakaari, White Island, the people in the system give above and beyond despite systemic handicaps. And so I really wanted to thank you for your insight into that moment in our history from the perspective of our health professionals. It was remarkable to read. And I want to ask, why did you start your book with that passage?
That's quite a funny story, actually. I actually wanted to end the book. So when I initially wrote it, that was my last chapter, because it was kind of, in comparison to the other stories, which were all very strongly tied to illustrating some issue with the system, this was more kind of a standalone story. It talks a little bit about the lack of a unified IT system and so on, but a lot of it is just for the sake of telling the story. And so I kind of had it at the end. And then as we were going through the editing process, my editor said, well, the first few chapters don't come across very well in the So maybe let's put this one at the start because that makes you come across really well. And so that was kind of how that came to be.
Okay. So simply a little bit of PR by putting that one first.
That's right.
But get us to like you before you start telling us how dark it is.
That's right, yeah.
I'm interested to know what you hoped to add to the discussion around the state of the New Zealand health system when you set out to write this book. And by that, I think, do you think people will find it shocking what you've written? And did you set out to incite anger? Like, what was going on? What did you hope to add?
Yeah, I think the whole exercise started off as just being kind of a personal journaling almost that was never meant to be read or seen by anybody. And then before I knew it, I'd written quite a lot. And I had to find a way, because people have written books about what it's like to be a doctor and working in the system before. And I wanted to make it kind of different from what had been done before. And it was around that time when I was really building up writing the stories where there started to be a lot of discussion in the media about issues with the health system, people's stories about being stuck in queues or dying in waiting rooms. And I thought there was a lot of discussion that was building, which was kind of very much, there's some issues we need to invest more, but it was kind of at a very superficial level. And I really wanted to delve in really deep and from the ground level, kind of really explore, well, what are the specific issues that we talk about? What are the subtleties that we need to be aware of? And when we talk about investing more, where are the places that needs to go? So that was kind of became how the book was going to be different. But then also I thought, this is really an opportunity to give people an insight into what things are like and give them some more. I didn't really want to set out to incite anger, but I wanted to have people, I guess, feel, have more information and feel emboldened to ask for change from their leaders and politicians.
Because change is needed, quite obviously. The book drills down, as you describe, to underlying issues, using your own experiences as examples of repeated situations. So they're told in an entertaining way, but they are very much examples that highlight specific issues. That process clearly substantiates the prescription that you offer at the end of the book. So congratulations for that very rational process. Some issues are easy for us to understand, okay? Yeah. So the kind of constipation in the hospital that comes from underfunded primary, community, aged and hospice care, okay? Most people will get that. But not many people will have insight into the scarcity economics between junior doctors, registrar specialists. Yeah. And can you tell us exactly why using specialists more efficiently is such a radical concept?
Yeah, I guess that kind of detail was what I was talking about in terms of trying to really nut down into that level. Where we're at the moment, we talk about needing more doctors, but when I graduated medical school, there were more of us graduating than there were jobs for us, and that's been the case before then, and it still continues to be the case today. And then what happens is you introduce all these doctors into the system, and to have them go through to the end and become specialists, they need to obtain training positions. And there's more junior doctors coming into the system than there are training positions for them, so there's kind of a bottleneck. And so what we're really short of, and need more in the system, is more specialists, because they're the people, you know, ultimately hold the responsibility, make the difficult decisions, deal with the complex cases. But as I said, there's a bottleneck of getting people through to that stage. People look at that bottleneck and they look at Australia, where they get paid more and there's more opportunities to get those training positions, so they leave. And so that's really one of the key problems when you talk about that. The other thing is, I think, as I highlight in the book, even the specialists that we have here, we could be, and this is an opinion that I have put forward that not necessarily a lot of these people may agree with, we could be using them a bit more efficiently in terms of earlier on in people's journey when they get into the hospital, because, as I said, they are the key decision makers. When you arrive to a hospital, you get seen by a junior doctor, but ultimately you are there for the opinion of the specialist. And that's where all the decision making comes from.
Yeah. But you also described not only how much more efficient that might be, but that it's radical in its nature, that that you might not be celebrated for that opinion or for sharing that opinion because of the kind of politics of specialism to some extent. I might not be summarising that very well, but do you understand? And I was just wondering if you want to talk a little bit more about that, tell the audience about the kind of the subtext, the culture, if you like, of protecting specialism.
I think you have to find a balance in that, because there is, you know, there's a natural hierarchy to the system, and if you say to specialists, well, you're going to just have to do all the work of junior doctors, that's not going to, nobody wants to do that, and that's not very incentivizing. And you have to provide an opportunity for people coming through to train and get that experience. So there's that kind of balance. I think it's more about, you know, it's not necessarily that the ways I talk about in terms of using the specialist more efficiently, I don't think necessarily many people would be opposed to what I kind of have in mind, which is not so much about making them work nights or extra hours or extra things, but just it comes from the way that the hospital is structured and that process when you come in and to the time you leave, how that's structured and which point people get involved. And so it's more about systems. So an example I have is at one of the hospitals I work at, there is a specialist who will hold one of the phones and take all the referrals coming in from GPs and outside the hospital, whereas that previous job had been done by more junior doctors. And that having that specialist there doing that job helps streamline things, make decisions faster, and that's well received by the specialist as well. So I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. I think
excellent.
They have systems that are more efficient, but and that people will be happy to work in.
Excellent. Thank you. Throughout, there are moments when you acknowledge that the pressure you describe as a junior doctor has always been seen just like kind of a necessary rite of passage or something and an inevitability. But ultimately, you don't really subscribe to that, do you? Is there anywhere that does it better, that holds itself to a higher standard in terms of care for the well-being of junior doctors? And where should we be looking for guidance about how to do it better?
Yeah, I think the main place where I see it is really about, you know, you have to give some credit. Things are better now for junior doctors than they were 30 years ago, for example. But there's a lot of examples I talk about in the book are examples of kind of, you know, bullying or harassment that are inherent in the system. And I think that kind of exists anywhere. And I think the real problem is that everyone else around, because it's only a minority of people, but it's everyone else around going, well, that's just, you know, a tough road you have to go down, and that's what you have to go through. That's just the way that person is. That's just the way it is. You just kind of buckle down and get through it. And I think it's the silence of the people around and not willing to do anything, which is kind of the problem, really.
Indeed. So that culture change is a long road. So Angel's story. And the story of Maud and her children whom you visit at home, they're very devastating examples that you give. Can you tell listeners more about rheumatic fever in New Zealand, who it impacts and what it indicates?
Yeah, so rheumatic fever is basically, it's a consequence of strep throat, which is an infection with the bacteria called group A strep. And mostly you get a sore throat with that, but you can get other skin infections and things. And in a small portion of people, particularly children, their immune systems can go on to have a complication of that infection, which then attacks the valves in the heart and damages them. And some kids might need heart operations to repair those damaged valves. It's mainly a disease of poverty, really. And as I point out, it's been eradicated in most developed countries in the world. And I tell the story of the British doctor who came over here and was kind of saying, well, this is great. I get to see something I've only ever read about in the textbooks. And I kind of am surprised and kind of ashamed by it, really. Mm. It's a disease mainly that results, we don't understand fully why it affects certain people. We do know that poverty is a huge problem, and particularly living in cold, damp, difficult to heat houses with overcrowding. Those are the two main factors that lead to strep throat and then lead to rheumatic fever. And we predominantly see that in our Maori and Pacific Island populations.
This story, Angel's story, is just heartbreaking, really, for humanising the impact of that and the loss of life as a consequence. So thank you for sharing that. With all the stories that you share, notably Angel's, were you concerned that people may read them just like entertainment, kind of almost like an episode of The Pit, without really buying into the call for action that you want to give in this book?
Yeah, there was a worry. I did think about that. There are books and other kind of media that tell patient stories, and some of them might, tell. As I've tried to tell stories in a funny, entertaining way, but they kind of focus on, stories that are slightly at the patient's expense. So, someone came and they had this funny thing happen to them and ha-ha. And so I tried really hard to avoid that. So I tried to make sure any story I told really wasn't that I tried to strongly tie whatever entertaining elements there may or may not be to some stronger message behind it.
Yeah.
So I wanted any story to be about the underlying issues rather than just about what here's a.
I think you achieved that extremely well, and nothing felt kind of frivolous in the telling of the stories, but they were extremely well told, and kind of the ED setting is an exhilarating setting to read stories in, or to so they're well told stories, but they certainly didn't feel frivolous, and the underlying reason was clear. I guess I'm really interested to know what level of hope that you have for us making any progress on the prescription for change that you offer on page 276. Maybe you could do that as like a score out of 10, with 0 being no hope, and then whatever notes on that are top of your mind just for today.
Yeah, score out of 10. I'm going to just go for middle of the road 5, just completely balance out the cynical and the hopeful side of me. I think I do write on the last page, I think even though I've called it a dim prognosis, I think the condition is still reversible, and it's up to us is the exact phrase I use, I think. I think that this is kind of a effort to just put everything on the table, everything that I think needs to change, and kind of a aim of shooting for you shoot for the stars, and if you get up onto a hill, that's kind of fine. And I don't hold any, the book is really directed at the general public. So I don't hold any hope that a politician or someone's going to read this and go, oh, this changes my opinion. I think having people more informed, a little bit outraged, as you say, and then it can be like a cumulative thing. So it may kick off that some people feel more empowered to talk about their own experiences, and then that kind of builds, and, it might be a process that takes 5, 10 years, 20 years, who knows, but it may just be a, yeah. So I'm hopeful that change will happen, but I think it will be a slow process, and I think it will be a cumulative process.
Certainly a cumulative process. But I don't think you should underestimate the power of the book. I think it's I would be surprised if some of your coming interviews over the next few days didn't start to get a little bit grittier. So be prepared for that, because I think that there's a lot for people who are making decisions to sit up and take notice of in your story and in, as I say, how well substantiated your observations are. There's so much drama, so much human drama and suffering and trauma that an ED doctor or, in fact, any health professional has to witness and sit with, right? Mm. I guess you train for that. So that's something that you prepare for. But how much worse is it to deal with when the root causes aren't just like the human condition, but clear and evident systemic failure? And sometimes, you know, blatant injustice, toxic culture, you know. So what's the impact of being in a system where human lives are playing out at their most poignant and vulnerable, and also having that subtext of rage going on for you? What's the impact of that on our health professionals, do you think?
Yeah, I think it does add that added element of, because you, no matter what, as you say, even if you have a perfect system, you'll have bad things happen to people, and that can be, you know, tough to deal with. And I think there's some situations where, even though you may not be able to, you know, for example, if you're talking about the chapter I talk about death and dying, even though situation where you cannot change the condition, you can still help someone to have a very dignified and comfortable death, and there's a lot of satisfaction in that. I think, as you say, that element, then when there are things happening that then are also due to the systemic factors, that can add a lot more frustration. So something I see pretty commonly in my kind of practice doing intensive care, and I come down to the ED to see a patient and, you know, they've really deteriorated, but the story you get is, well, they've kind of been in the waiting room for 6 hours and then they collapsed. And so I think, well, they really could have gotten onto this a lot earlier. I think as I talk about, there's a, you're kind of, you're a little bit helpless, and I guess part of the way you deal with that frustration for me was writing the book. Mm. But I think there's various ways that you can kind of cope with that, I guess. And I talk about the three phenotypes of people. There's those who just kind of let everything in and they kind of burn out pretty quickly. There's those who shut everything away, and they're kind of unpleasant people that you don't want to deal with. And for the majority of people, they kind of, you have to let stuff in, but you have to kind of dull the blade that it travels on. And the way I talk about it and what I have in the book is a lot of kind of gallows humor, basically, which I think helps you. There's various opinions. Some people think it's not a very useful thing. I think it is. I think it helps you process things in a way that is a little bit more palatable.
Mm. Yeah, no, and absolutely. I think it also helps you make your point in a way that perhaps people can't help themselves letting it get in a wee bit. So thank you very much. Thank you, Ivor. Thank you so much. And unfortunately, that is all that we're going to have time for. You might be grateful for that. The book is A Dim Prognosis by Ivor Popovic, and it's published by Allen and Unwin and available at all good booksellers nationwide.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
End Your Fight with Food, How to Change Your Eating Habits for Good, is the third self-help book written by positive psychologist and nutritionist Claire Turnbull. The cover art makes it clear that dieting, scales, binging, guilt, and rules are not the way forward. And the book sets out to support readers to take a path to wellness that is hopefully more sustainable than any of those options. Claire joins me this morning to share some insights with our Bookends listeners. Tēnā koe, Claire.
Thank you for having me.
It's great. Thank you very much for joining us. So, your jacket photo, and now that I get to see you in person as well, it all makes you look very young for the lived experience that you outline in the book. Can you give the readers a little insight into your early life in England, the origins of your own food-related wellness journey, and where you're at now?
Yeah, so I grew up, like a lot of people in the 80s, watching my mum go on and off diet. So dieting then was very overt. It's very obvious. It was, you know, on all the magazines. It wasn't just like healthy eating. It was really get skinny, get smaller. And my mum was just literally always on a diet, always commenting on her body. And my dad's a doctor, worked crazy long hours. And I often went with my mum to the Weight Watchers meetings and the Slimmers World meetings and all sorts of different things that she was doing. And I was just sat there with a book reading, you know, and I think she'd think I wasn't listening, but obviously you're absorbing all this information. And even though she never gave us any negative messages about our body, one of the things I've learned now is it's not what you say to your children that matters. It's what you're doing yourself, because they are watching what you do. And that's still a very relevant message for today. So anyway, watching her in that situation, I was bullied very badly when I was at school, really wasn't, had no self-confidence, was in a terrible place. And at the age of 9, I ended up just kind of like picking up one of her books and thinking, someone had called me a bit chubby at school, and my dance teacher had commented on the size of my legs and said that they were too, you know, thick to be a dancer. And so I picked up this book, not feeling very good about myself. And at the age of 9, that was the beginning of 20 plus years of going on and off various different diets. So at 9, I was just playing around with it. You know, I was just following these things and skipping, having my breakfast, throwing away my lunch and just trying to do things like that. And then I kind of, as I got into my teenage years, this is very common when people restrict what they're eating and then they can't control themselves around food. So I would go to sleepovers, I would have friends over, and I would literally eat, you know, bags and bags of crisps and bars of chocolate. And then I was like, oh, that was terrible. I shouldn't have done that. And then I'd try and find something else to stop eat for another couple of days. And this is the dieting cycle that we see. So it might, you know, not have started at 9 for a lot of people. But whatever reason that you start going into some kind of restriction around food, the common other side of that is that then you can't maintain it and you end up kind of feeling out of control around food. And so the cycle goes on. So yeah, that was my kind of journey with food. Through that whole aspect, I really did struggle with my mental health. I was in a really bad place many, many times. And it was all kind of a messy situation in there. So, yeah, a kind of crazy start to that all.
Yeah, for sure. But a journey from there back to wellness, Claire. So perhaps fill us a little bit in on that and on your professional journey that means that you end up gifting us this book so that other people don't end up in the same situation.
Yeah, so I kept coming from a medical family. So my brother's a doctor, my mum's a nurse. I was kind of always going to go down the medical route. So when I was figuring out what to do at university, I was like, oh, what am I going to do? Am I going to do speech and language therapy, physiotherapy? And then nutrition and dietetics was also one of those options. And I thought to myself, do you know what? Like, I've really struggled with this food thing for a really long time. If I learn everything there is to know about food, maybe I can get myself sorted and then maybe I can help other people. And the irony of that is after studying 4 years full time, and also I became a qualified fitness instructor, my eating was worse than ever. Wow. And that was because back then, it's different now. The training was very still focused on the diet culture, right? Like it really was. There was no psychology in it. There was no understanding of eating behavior. So even with all that knowledge, even knowing exactly what I needed to be eating, I still couldn't do it after a 4-year full-time degree, you know? And I ended up moving to New Zealand. That's actually how I ended up over here, because what I thought was, listen, all this, I don't know, if I live somewhere different, if I'm somewhere different, it's all going to go away. And it didn't. So when I got here, I completely fell apart, had a total mental health breakdown, and ended up finally getting some help and support through the work of a psychologist who helped me realize that food was a symptom, not the cause. And it was a way that I was managing my life, my feelings, my stress, and my constantly going on and off diets and trying to manage my body was actually to do with my self-worth, my self-esteem. And food was just the coping strategy. There's all sorts of coping strategies that people use in their life, and alcohol for it, that got in the mix of that in my 20s. So that's when I kind of went down that route and started discovering Oh, there's another side to this. Why do we eat when we do? What's driving our eating choices? Why do we eat when we tell ourselves we're not? Why can't we follow these plans? And I kind of like then had to look much deeper as to what's underneath, what drives us to eat, and who are we? What's going on underneath it all?
Wow, that's amazing. And so in your own personal, you look very well at the moment, and your book is indicates that you're in a great place. But for listeners who haven't read your book, perhaps just tell them a snippet of your current state relative to food. You're in a balanced place and feel good about your life and yourself, and you're eating well.
I am. Yeah.
Cool. I think that's neat for listeners to hear, when knowing that that there's another side, because I think disordered eating, that to the extent that any of our listeners have got that really extreme disordered eating and really dark mental health issues that you've struggled with, I think it's amazing to know that there's a healthy future.
Absolutely. And do you know what? I remember every single day of my life, probably from about the age of 15, walking into the bathroom, standing on the scales while I had them there, but then looking in the mirror and telling myself, not today, Claire, you're not going to binge today. You're going to eat normally today. Every single day. And I, even in my like my mid 20s, I thought to myself, I am never going to get out of this. And I cannot believe, even to this day now, to think that it is possible to get to the point where you can have one chocolate biscuit and just not eat the rest of the packet. The fact that I can have a glass of wine and put the bottle back in the fridge. Like, I literally never, ever thought, if someone had told me that, I'd tell them they were lying. But I really realise now, when you detach yourself from this horrible thing that goes on with food, where you feel controlled by it, rather than you feeling like you're in the kind of driving seat of your food choices.
Well, huzzah.
Is absolutely possible. Yeah.
Huzzah and congratulations for your own healing journey. And thank you for your book. So your dedication in the book is very lovely. Parents who inspire you to show up, be brave and learn from hard things. And you also talk in the book quite a lot about imposter syndrome, okay? And about the whole universe of self-help stuff that there is already on weight, body image and stuff. So, but in the end, something gave you confidence that what you had to share was uniquely valuable and could help others. What's uniquely valuable, do you believe, in that whole world of stuff, and given your own imposter syndrome, what gave you the confidence, and how did you know that what you've got here is uniquely valuable for people who are suffering?
Because I have got to a place in my life where I tried to take my own life before, really, really dark place. I actually thought, I've got to the stage now, I'm 43 this year, that I was like, you know what, if it takes me being absolutely brutally honest about the stuff that I go through to help other people, rather than just being the professional that says that this is what you need, like, that's what I'm going to do. Because I was given a second opportunity at life, because someone walked in my bedroom on the day that I was going to make a very bad choice. And from that point on, I was 19 years old. I will forever be grateful for every day that I get, because it's a bonus to me. I just honestly feel that what people need when it comes to things that they're struggling with is something that they relate to, not just someone saying, you know, eat this, follow these things, or follow my journey, I do this every day. It's like, their life isn't relatable to yours. For anyone that is listening, like, whatever has led you to feel like you can't, you know, you're on this dieting roller coaster, or you're trying the next thing and you just constantly feel bad about yourself, please know that I do understand. That can look really different for different people. And it's just, I wanted to write the book because I know that people need to read this information from somebody that gets it, rather than somebody that is just has learned it and then telling other people about it. It's quite a different experience.
Fabulous, fabulous. I don't know whether you know Lotta Dan's book, Mrs. D Is Not on a Diet. Have you read it?
I do know the name of it. I've actually not read it. I'm actually weirdly dyslexic. This is a funny thing.
Wow.
which means I really, really struggle to, I actually struggle to read. I've never read a novel in my life. Not because I don't want to. So I listen to audiobooks is my life, because that's literally made all books accessible to me, and I'm super grateful for that.
Oh, cool. Well, just that's cool and interesting to know about you as well. But the reason I mentioned Lotta Danz is because she also we interviewed her recently. She documents this personal story about giving herself permission to eat. So you reference the same theory in here about this permission. And Lotta's book describes in a very relatable way how hard it is for women to reprogram themselves to that permission. Why is it so fraught? Why is permission to eat so fraught, Claire?
Because since we were little girls, we were told that we shouldn't eat too much, that if you eat too much, you get fat. You know, and even if it wasn't said that directly to us, indirectly, most of us will know as girls growing up, we were judged for how our bodies looked. It was completely acceptable, you know, when I was growing up and in the many years after, for other people to comment on your body. And then the logical link with dieting and messaging around food about restriction, eat less, just have a bit more self-control, be more organized, whatever else, then shows a very direct link between eating less, i.e. not giving yourself permission to eat, and living in a smaller body. Mm. And it is so hard to shake that, to allow yourself that. And I absolutely get it. And I know it is terrifying when you first start. But what I really want to also say, you know, say to people listening is, like, in the book, if you've eaten a certain way for 20, 30, 40 years and you've had these things deeply embedded since you were a child, you were rewarded with food, you were told to eat everything on your plate, you were, you know, you use food to manage all sorts of emotional states that you have, stress, angry, loneliness, all these different things. You can't change that in 6 weeks. And I'm not going to lie to people saying that you can. It's actually a process of understanding yourself. And then it is this slow reprogramming. And part of that, to your point, is this permission piece.
Mm. Yeah, no, amazing. I guess it's a topic that leans into so many negative messages we have about our ownership of our bodies, you know, our sovereignty in our bodies. Mm-hmm. So you say that, you know, you canvas it really well. And those are deep things that take time to change. So in your book, you move well beyond just talking about how hard it is to some quite practical steps, very, very specific steps about make a four-step process for making a plan to change a habit. So quickly, can you tell the authors, tell the readers about that four-step process?
Yeah, so I think this is because I'm dyslexic. I need, like, really clear instructions to follow. So that's really what I've tried to do in the book, to make it easy and practical. So the first stage of change is awareness. If you're not aware of what you're doing, why you're eating, why they're drinking, you're in the situation, you can't change anything. And it's really important with that to be non-judgmental. So the first step, I encourage people to keep a record of what they're eating and drinking and look at it from a different lens, not of judgment, of interest. Curiosity. So that's kind of what I get people to do. Then the second part of that is reflecting on that, like, what's going on here? So what are the patterns? Oh, okay, so I have conflict with my partner and I often, you know, go to the Tim Tams. I'm in a difficult situation at work, and when I've had an argument at work, I often seem to go past the donuts on the petrol station on the way home. There will be many patterns that happen that you'll find go over and over again. And then what I encourage people to do is label those patterns. Detach the pattern of behavior from who you are. If you are driving past the petrol station 3 times a week to buy whatever, drink, pie, donut, that's not who you are. That's just a pattern of behavior that you've got into. So I labeled all of my coping strategies when I was eating jars of Nutella and picking and drinking more than I wanted to be. And then it's about this process of reprogramming that. And basically, it's just finding a plan that works for you. Can you drive a different way home if it's the petrol station that's the trigger? When you have a really difficult situation or confrontation with your partner or your children or at work, what can you do instead of walking to the cafe downstairs at work? Like, so it's then just coming up with a plan. And that's how you change. Just hoping and willing and telling yourself you're going to do it is never going to work. You need the practical strategies and the toolkit to get through.
No, that's amazing. And it's, listeners, it is well documented in the book, and it's obviously the output of a lot of science as well as a lot of lived experience. I also just would love your wheel of well-being. And so the fact that this isn't just about food, this is so much about psychology and your own and a whole approach to wellness. So I think we don't have time, unfortunately, to go into that. But I, if there was, what I was interested to know was, how did you pull those pieces of the wheel together? Like, how was that? Was that the subject of a postgraduate, or have you worked? How many people have you worked with, and where does it all come from? That wheel of well-being.
Yes, the wheel of well-being very quickly is nourishment, movement. It is the sleep piece, which is really important. Stress management, relationships, most importantly, the relationship with yourself, how you talk to yourself in your own head, and having a sense of meaning and purpose. Where did I come from that from? I got to the point where nutrition and exercise can only get you so far. I had a nervous breakdown, essentially, a complete breakdown after COVID. I have a neurodivergent child, and that whole situation with my dad being diagnosed with cancer, losing my father-in-law, neurodivergent child, pushed me into this thing of like, well-being is so much more than what you eat and how you exercise. So I ended up retraining, doing positive psychology, and then basically pulling aspects of that and how to really practically manage stress without eating and drinking as the solution, and how to look after yourself. So all that's become part of it, because you can't look after yourself. Eating and moving your body is not enough to be holistically well. It's all those other pieces that come together.
And it describes that very well, and it feels very intuitively sensible and supportive for a well-nourished person rather than just a well-nourished body. So, Claire, thank you so much. Just quickly, where can people who are really struggling at the moment, can you provide us with a recommendation for where they can get help?
Yeah, so obviously grab yourself a copy of my book, but I have a team of dietitians and nutritionists who've been working alongside me for 20 years now, missionnutrition.co.nz. And so we offer that personalised piece. So what I've found is a lot of people have read the book, got the kind of basics there. And then if you really, really need a deep dive and someone to hold your hand as you go through that process, my team at Mission Nutrition can absolutely help.
Thank you so much. The book is End Your Fight with Food by Claire Turnbull. It's published by Allen and Unwin, and it's available from booksellers nationwide.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rath, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.